This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
My name is Rachel Dunn. We're at Rachel Dunn Chocolates in Concord, California.
I know your name and I know your chocolate. Somehow you got great distribution because it was not in Concord. It was a long ways away where I saw your chocolate and my wife buys it.
We've been making confections for about 30 years and all by word of mouth.
But your chocolate, it's in, like it seems I remember it in hotels or... Where would you find it in California, retail?
If you are familiar with Clif Family, the company who makes Clif Bars,
Yeah. We
do lovely work for them. And in high-end, lovely establishments that cater to people who are all about good food and living experiences. We do things that are lovely and fresh and with ingredients that are cared for.
Cared for ingredients. Talk to us about sourcing your chocolate cacao from Hawaii.
It's a brand new industry there in Hawaii, and we have different farms who are growing different varieties of the pods. It's in extremely limited supply, but it's lovely. It's beautiful chocolate, and maybe it'll take 10 years or so for the industry itself to mature. But cocoa grows 20 degrees north and south of the equator, and Hawaii is 21 degrees. So some of the beans are just remarkable. And it's not only that they're rare because there's such a tiny supply, but rare in that the species are so delicious and unique.
Let's talk about the fragility, the nuances of growing cacao and your little bugs that are so vital. What a great story.
Chocolate is absolutely a noble food, and all the way from the trees and the midge that pollinates the flowers on the trees.
Well, this little tiny bug, a midge, without that bug, there is no chocolate. Tell us about that important role that little guy plays.
That is correct. The midge's whole purpose in life is to pollinate the cacao, the little flowers, and they look kind of like miniature orchids, and they come out on the trunk of the tree. And this midge goes and pollinates them and dies within 24 hours. And their living circle is about a 3-mile radius. Their whole purpose is to pollinate these trees. Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah. So they don't work with any other trees. They only want the little the chocolate. Talk to us about growing the cacao plant and how that fragility, you know, having to reach an X amount of height or it dies. I mean, that's crazy.
The trees themselves are so fragile and susceptible, not because of any blight or bug or anything like that, but because they are such a fragile species. They require a certain amount of wind, a certain amount of shade, a certain amount of sun, a certain amount of moisture. Any one of those components are too severe, they die. And as they're coming up, they've got these lovely leaves and, you know, big, lush green. If the plant doesn't come up to 21 leaves, if it gets to 20 leaves, it dies. It has to get to 21 to be a surviving. Every step along the way, it's fragile.
Today, what percentage of your chocolate production is sourced from Hawaii?
There will always be a limited supply. There will always be, because it cannot be grown on all the Earth's surfaces in Hawaii. There are too many variables that just because there's land and water doesn't mean that the trees will thrive.
Where is your primary source? Where is the Oh My God chocolate come from?
Oahu.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
That's fascinating. And how about South America and Costa Rica, maybe?
We have made two lovely chocolates from Costa Rica. You have to think about the equator, 20 degrees north and south of the equator. And so you think about some areas will have a great year, and that same area 5-6 years down the road will have a poor crop, very much like wine grapes. So if there's a great crop in Costa Rica this year, and maybe it has pineapple notes or lemon or orange notes, something very interesting, and then next year they have a poor year, But in the Dominican Republic, there's a set of trees that produces something that tastes very much the same, that has pineapple notes or papaya, things like that. So,
and how about going further over Africa? Do you source from there?
The beans from Africa right now are from Tanzania. We have two co-op farms there. They and you have to understand, picture in your mind for farm, if you're in America, you think of long rows, right, for as far as the horizon goes. These are not how it's grown there. A farm might be 1 or 2 hectares, a mom and a dad, a family, a couple of daughters.
They have to co-op.
They do. And the way that the beans work is that when they cut the pods off the trees, they have 24 hours from the time they cut the pod off the tree to have it open, the seeds scooped out, and those seeds in a box already fermenting. So the co-op really provides a useful function where these families, they don't have enough beans to sell, but if they go in with all their neighbors and, you know, they have trees up the hill or down the way, and everybody can add these beans to the co-op, then the fermentation boxes are happening on a timely and orderly fashion.
Talk to us about ethics and ethical sourcing of ingredients.
I absolutely love that question. Thank you for that. We deal direct with our farmers. These are people like you and me. They just live around the world. We're buying our beans direct from them. There are not 5 or 10 middlemen in between, and the beans aren't from 5 years ago with no identification, nothing. We know where they're coming from. We know the ruts in the road. We know the problem that the rains came in and washed out the back of the barn out. Those kind of friendships make this business real for them and real for us. And if you think about the supply, to supply a company like us, we would be a speck on the map for Hershey or Mars or any company like that. They couldn't even consider buying from farmers like that. It would make no sense at all. But for us, those beans are precious.
You are a boutique manufacturer of chocolate, so it's a perfect marriage. It really
is. It is. And we provide the avenue for them to sell their beautiful beans, and we make the beautiful chocolate out of it. We don't want to make, you know, a million tons. That's not our lot in life.
Your clientele, how much are they aware and how much do they appreciate those extra lengths that you guys go to?
I think every person who gets to come into this factory, we are so excited to share with them how it happens, what happens.
But coming to the source is one thing. But I have seen your product way far away from Concord, California. And only because of the elegance of the packaging do I presume, oh my God, this has to be good stuff. But you don't really know. You know, how do you get that word beyond the borders of the county?
You know, it's difficult because for me, I'm in love with this. I'm in love with it. And I could talk to you for hours and you would be, you know, begging to go home by that point.
I'd probably be begging for more.
But some folks want to buy and they want to feel good about what they're buying and what they're eating. Other folks want to be educated. They want to know where it came from. Anybody who asks, we're happy to tell them. Anyone who asks is, but it's hard to cram down the information to people. Is not fun if they're not interested in that.
Sure.
They expect value and they expect quality. And now that people are wanting to be educated and they don't want to feel bad about where they're getting their products from or serving it to their guests, so I appreciate that.
To that other extreme where you intentionally want to support the small producers.
Yeah, and we appreciate the alignment. I love that.
It seems to me that a challenge for you guys is it doesn't matter how awesome and how incredible your chocolate is, if you don't connect with that targeted consumer, then you got a whole bunch of inventory. How do you best get your product out there and connect with the consumer?
Well, we're a fresh maker. We don't make inventory and sit on it. First of all, everything we do here is fresh. Some chocolate actually ages, and it's better when it ages.
How long?
Depending on the bean and if it's a milk chocolate versus dark. So some of it is 2 weeks or maybe 2 months. It changes flavors or something is more pronounced or more rounded. But we're a fresh maker, and so word of mouth has grown our business, and the internet is where people find us and they purchase from us, and a lot of times they just want the phone number from the internet and then they'll call us.
So mail order and shipping is huge.
Yep.
Percentage of your business.
Yep. It's a huge part of our business. And that is bypassing on purpose, bypassing the distribution system where you manufacture something. You send it out, the next person needs a 12 to 24 month shelf life, the next person needs a 9 month shelf life, and that just is not our model. We make fresh and we want you to eat it fresh and give it fresh and enjoy it fresh. It's meant for that.
And I know that there are a lot of wineries around the area that love your chocolate because it is such a perfect marriage. And so it goes without saying that I'm sure you could find your chocolate in some wineries in the region.
That's correct. Cliff Family, the makers of Cliff Bar, we're in Cliff Family Winery. We are in Concannon.
Oh.
We're in Steel Wines. Yeah, there's we are fortunate that there are so many lovely wineries here to partner with.
So Petite Syrah is a great mix for your chocolate.
That's right, mm-hmm. With the Venezuelan 58.
I'll take that. Why does chocolate marry so well with wine?
Oh, because it's so complex. Someone who's drinking wine for the enjoyment, it is a ride of flavor. You go on a journey. When you taste old wines and interesting wines and rare wines and things like that, it's about the journey. It's not about quickly drinking and getting drunk. It's all about the taste journey. That
is what's happening chemically, molecularly, that makes both transform and shift and enhance in the flavor profile. Why did chocolate become married with love, the whole process of love?
That's actually the scientific, the physical thing that actually happens in your brain when you eat chocolate. That's actually what happens, is it kicks on that same
the love gene,
neurotransmitters. It's exactly the same. But you know, there's a physical side to it, but much bigger than that for me is honestly when you're tasting this chocolate and you get it. All of our taste buds are unique, just like our fingerprints, right? So when you taste something and you go, oh, that's good, and you taste something and you say, that's all right, and you taste something and you go, oh my gosh, what is that? That is so true for you, because your taste buds said to you, oh my gosh, that is something unique to me. It's the flavor journey. That part of it, nobody can just give to you. You have to physically experience it. That's what I love about this. The chocolate, all the flavor that's in it, you don't know what's going to trip your taste buds. Might be different than mine, but it's real. It's true for you, and it's true for me.
So when you have time off, do you go and taste other chocolates?
Absolutely. I have $1,200 library right now, nonstop. Everywhere we go, we taste chocolate, we look at it, we look at the construction of it, the thickness, the viscosity. We take it all apart because that's what we do analytically, and the textures and tasting all of that. It is like, I don't know, if you're into board games, that would be ours, would be tasting chocolate. Remember when we were little and you would get a box of chocolate and you'd take a little bite or you'd push the bottom to see what was inside of it? I still do that.
That's great.
It is such a fun game.
You can't resist, can you?
No, it's the surprise factor, and you're delighted if it's a color inside. Is there blackberries in there? But it's still fun.
I love it. So do you make the bars? That's what I see primarily. But then in the bags, what are those?
That is couverture chocolate. It's made for chefs, whether it's home chefs or fine dining chefs. This is really high percentage of cocoa butter, and the couverture chocolate literally means to drape the pieces so you can have a very specific inside of the chocolate. If you wanted to have like two layers, very different, one crispy, one creamy, and you have this very thin draping of shell on the outside, and the point is to be flavorful but not in the way. And there's a physical change. If you chew chocolate in the back of your mouth where the molars are, your brain's telling you to hurry up and swallow, and so you're chewing quickly and to get it past the mouth. With the Couverture chocolate, it's so thin that it's melting on the front of the mouth rather than chewing on the molars, and so you're immediately into the flavor rather than swallowing.
So it's a totally different flavor profile because of the taste buds that are up front, right?
And the experience that you're literally the amount of time that it's in your mouth, that it's right from the moment that you're putting it in the mouth, it's melting. And you know, we love fat. We love butter, we love coconut, we love fat with cocoa butter. So all of the fat releases the flavor just like that. So if you're chewing at the back of your mouth and swallowing, you're bypassing all the flavor. So the Couverture chocolate, we make those in a lovely Tahitian white chocolate, the 41% milk chocolate, and then the chef blends are 58%, 65%, and 70%.
Pretty powerful.
Well, we have a 98% also.
Wow.
Called Midnight Blend.
Nice.
And you know what's fun about that? You know what's fun about that? You and me grew up, and our mothers had in our cabinets this stuff called Baker's chocolate.
Yeah.
And if you got into that chocolate and ate it, you'd think, why did you trick me? That's terrible. It's inedible. And our moms cooked fudge with it. That was chocolate liquor, just the same as my 98% is. The difference is the beans. If you have a bulk bean and it's just, it's chocolate, it's hard, it's square, that's what it is. This 98% is made from 5 different flavor beans. So although it's in the absence of sugar, all the flavor, all those beautiful flavors are present. So you're tasting something completely, all the taste is there and it's bitter, but it's not inedible. It's quite the opposite. Our mothers didn't have this. It didn't exist when our moms were cooking.
Let's talk sea salt for a moment, because that's really magic.
Sea salt is very cool that the salt industry is actually exploding, because all the different salts, you know, have different minerals in them, different sweetnesses, different surfaces, depending if it's a flake salt or cubic, how many sides it has, all that determines how you taste the salt. And so when we add salt to chocolate, it actually makes the sweetness changed. And it delays the sugar. Also, when you taste the, like for instance, the sea salt caramel, the salt you taste first and it delays the sweetness, but then when you taste it, it's almost in parallel with a little bit of a bitter. Or if you're using a black sea salt from Hawaii, that's very interesting because it almost goes savory. So you're tasting sweet with savory almost.
Fascinating. Only because we're running short on time, give us a quick overview of World Headquarters. Because right now, I mean, I have an apron on and I got yanked out of a chocolate making class. You do that on a regular basis. And there are a lot of stations out there. So you probably get quite a few people that come here. You have corporate retreat people and locals. Tell us about that real quick.
Absolutely. We love to teach classes and get people hands-on. They can ask us questions and this is the only place where you can come and actually understand and learn how to make chocolate.
Can you do it individually or is it groups only?
We do public and private workshops. Our private workshops start at 20 people, and we have lovely groups who like to come and do team building or family events, things like that, where they can really control the noise of the group, right. That kind of thing. And then our public workshops, we have about 70 people in a class, up to 74 or something in a class.
And how do they find out? How would somebody sign up for one of your classes?
All online. Our outreach is all online for
and
our classes.
That is what? Where do you go?
It is racheldunnchocolates.com.
Before we go, tell us about some of the incredible people that you've presented your chocolate with, like TV people. I saw some of the pictures of famous people. That's incredible.
I love that they've found us. I appreciate when people come from all walks of life and they're world travelers and they choose us. That is just thanks for what we're doing. I know it's amazing. I know it's special. But when somebody has access to the world and they choose our chocolate, I'm grateful for that. Most recently, John Mellencamp. Well, anyway, John Mellencamp, what can I say? We make great gifts for him. And
but you were on some TV shows, right?
We've been on quite a few. We were
Food Network.
We were on the Food Network several times. We were on QVC. Oprah chose us as one of her must-haves. We've been on the Rosie O'Donnell Show. We've been on the Today Show. Lots of TV. When people want to talk about real flavor and real food and real producers, they call us. If they're talking about doing a fun, kitschy kind of a juvenile thing, which there's a place for that. There's a young population where they need to do something fun, the moms and kids and things. They call us when they're talking about flavor and sustainability and really rare and beautiful chocolate. That's when we get to go.
Mike Dunn here. How are you guys doing?
Doing really good. It says Michael Dunn, but you go by Mike.
Mike or Michael, either one's fine.
You're a chocolate maker, and that would be a chocolatier?
It's not. Actually, a chocolate maker actually makes the chocolate from the beans, and a chocolatier uses the chocolate that's made from the beans.
All right, so you're primary and they're secondary.
Interestingly, I'm both, because we not only make candy from sugar, the brittles, the caramels, and all these different things, nougats, and turons, but we actually make chocolate from the bean. And we've been at this a long time, so I have zero excuse not to make exquisite products. And we were blessed early on, Rachel and I, we met a company called Bernichon out of Lyon, France. Now, she and I at that time were 17 and 19, and we were making things like blackberry cordials out of the berries from the gully besides our little house, and we had a cottage industry license.
Where did you live at that time?
That was in Oakland, Oregon, of all things, the second oldest town and probably the smallest town in Oregon.
And that's where you two grew up?
That's where I grew up, and she met me there. So we were making these berry cordials and different beautiful things, and cute little Rachel marched into Saks Fifth Avenue in San Francisco with a platter of her candies, and we didn't know you had to meet with a buyer or do anything like that. And it turns out the New York buyer, the San Francisco, and the Chicago buyers were all right there.
Total coincidence.
Total coincidence, and just knocked them flat. Now suddenly we need a factory.
Wow. And you guys are like 18 years old? Or?
17 and 19, yeah. So we've been at this a long time, and apparently Bernichon had come into Bergdorf Goodman's, which we were selling to next after Saks and along with Saks. And they tasted these blackberry cordials, and they thought, this is the chocolate in America. Frankly, the Europeans at that time thought chocolate in America was chocolat, you know, shockingly terrible chocolate.
You think of Hershey's, you think of milk chocolate. And
well, Hershey's, you know, they started out, they were a caramel company until 1900. They were huge. And they got a shipment of this brand new thing, which was spray-dried milk and cream powder from Europe, and it came soured. It was warm weather on the trip over, and the boat was really slow, and the milk and cream soured, and so they couldn't make caramel with it. So they decided, you know, we can't waste this mountain of perfectly edible ingredients, just not good for caramel. So they added cocoa powder and a whole bunch of sugar, and they made an 11% milk chocolate. And to this day, they exactly honor that recipe. And we make 41% milk chocolate in a totally different process. But I have to tell you, our ancestors thought that 11% was scary dark chocolate.
And now we can take some 90%, right?
That's true. That's true. It's really hard to make high-strength, high-test, if you will, chocolate elegantly. And the trick is to, in my opinion, is to blend fruity chocolate with some of the base chocolates, in other words, the broad-shouldered chocolatey chocolates, to get something that simulates sweetness so that you can actually eat it. It's much more elegant and harder to make a good, really, really dark chocolate. But most people don't realize where chocolate switches from candy and into food is about 55% if you're using the right sugar. Table sugar is terrible for people. It's got a really high glycemic index and a really low sweetness.
So what is the optimal sugar to use?
Confectioner's AA sugar. Don't confuse that with triple X, which is powdered sugar. AA is the first big pure crystals that come out of the sugar-making process. What most people don't know is that sugar cane, the peel of the cane, is full of latex and other things that when you condense that, in other words, you're evaporating the cane juice, which you would think evaporated cane juice sugar, turbinado sugar, would be the best, but it's full of natural ash, and that sappy tar out of the peels. So not the best thing for you to eat. The Con AA is the healthiest sugar you can eat. It's very sweet with a very low glycemic, so you can use less. And that's what we use in our candy and our chocolate.
So you've been at this, what, almost 40 years?
Yeah.
And you have this passion that you could have just shifted jobs. This could have been a new career for you. You have that wide-eyed fascination today.
Yeah, no, it's very true. I went from being a chocolatier to being a chocolate maker in an absolute burning comet of passion. I'm not kidding. I couldn't sleep. You know, it's nice to have that kind of a passion at 60, you know, and to have this whole thing come full circle. Now, I've known darn good and well what is and is not good chocolate for years and years. And I mentioned earlier we'd met Bernichon in 82. Now, these guys in suits, these French guys, come to our little cottage. Can you imagine how embarrassingly uncomfortable that was?
That's funny. Yeah, an awkward moment, huh?
Very much so. I mean, you've got French guys in suits, and here's Rachel and I, you know, I think we were in our 20s at that point, early 20s. But they were very kind, and they introduced us to Couverture chocolate and gave us a great big selection of their bars and their different candies, and it changed our world.
Why did they care about you guys? What was in it for them? Why were they? Was it truly greater good?
You know, it was. They were looking to see if America's palate was ready for French-style chocolate. And at that time, the answer was no. You know, to this day, nobody really knows what Couverture chocolate is here. And you can't even spare a square foot of shelf space at Safeway or wherever for it because nobody knows what it is. You're never getting in there with us.
And try to explain for the novice, somebody like me, how is it different? How is it delineated and defined that makes it so exceptional?
Okay. Couverture means to cover, first of all. And so we tend to grind the chocolate down very fine. Chocolate chips are really huge particles of cacao with cocoa butter in between, and ours is ground down to minus 20 microns. That's so fine you will detect no texture.
Behind us is a mill that you found, in Venezuela. Is that part of the magic?
It is, actually. What that does is pre-grind the chocolate cold.
I need to interrupt. That's like 120 years old or something you found in a jungle?
118 years old. We saw it in a satellite photo. Apparently there'd been a little bit of a fire or they'd burnt a bit of the jungle back to plant something else. And here's this rusty hulk of a machine, and I knew what it was. And I was hoping it was numbers matching because you can't mix parts on these machines. They're handmade. If you do and put it together, it'll grind itself to bits in almost no time. And this was numbers matching, and it looked terrible. It was rusty. You know, it had been 60 years in the jungle, but oddly, that moisture protected the iron in the machine. So what it does is grind the beans into liquid called cocoa liqueur, and during that one-hour process, it knocks the volatiles out, the vinegar, the acetone, all the different things that happen when you ferment anything boil off. It's like cheese and crackers dunked in chocolate times a thousand, so strong it makes your eyes water, but it's awesome.
So that really is part of the magic.
It is. Once that process is over, it's moved into a finishing conch, usually for about 24 hours, and the particle size goes down in a very even fashion to minus 20 microns with about 38% cocoa butter. So it's very thin and viscous chocolate, which is perfect for dunking strawberries or dipping fine chocolates in.
In your packaging and processing, that's all done here too?
It is. We're interesting in that we make everything here that we sell here. And I know that's rare because we sell chocolate and candy to so many different companies. We're probably the seventh largest chocolate maker in North America.
That's incredible. Is that partly because there are proprietary labels on your chocolate?
Yes, we make a lot of different products for a lot of different people.
And where would somebody maybe find your chocolate if they're traveling around the country in America?
Yep. Anytime you're eating chocolate on a pier in America, you're probably eating some of our chocolate. But specifically, we mostly sell our high-end products online. Of course, you can always come to our factory store. And we're just now starting to push the high-end Couverture chocolate bars out into the American public. And it's a different product. And so there's always the struggle with, do you price it correctly, which is too high, or do you underprice it and put it out? Currently, we're about $8 for a 2-ounce chocolate bar. Our contemporaries are about $10, but none of them are making Couverture chocolate, and they really don't have the, you know, the years and years of expertise, so it's the Wild West of chocolate.
You are very competitive then, very much so.
Yeah, less so, because we're kind of the Kleenex of, or the Clorox of chocolate, in that at this level of chocolate, there's really very few makers in the United States. A few years ago, it was only 11. I think it's up to around 100 now, but again, a lot of these guys are, they're new, they're going to do all kind of crazy things, good and bad, but out of that will come some really cool things. So in the chaos of new, there's always some wonderful things, so I look forward to what's coming.
As a reference, Lindt chocolate, Swiss chocolate.
Yeah, Lindt chocolate was like most European chocolate. It's finely ground and it has plenty of cocoa butter, but it's got one more ingredient that I don't love. You see, the big processors haven't figured out, or don't want to figure out, how to get rid of the shells off the cocoa bean. The cocoa bean itself is 90% bean and 10% shell, and the shell is the most dusty, nasty, acrid-tasting thing ever. Very much like the shell of an egg, you don't want to eat it for much the same reasons. And their processes are so huge, they simply can't get them out. We actually had to invent our own machinery to remove the shells. We're getting 99.8% shell removal, which is incredible.
That's really the game changer then.
Yeah.
Nuances of flavor.
Yep, that and processing in the old-fashioned French method like we're doing. So we're a mixture of 118-year-old technology and brand-new technology, and using the best benefits of both. It's so nice that Americans are, and I'm an American, so don't get me wrong on that, are experiencing a whole new renaissance in chocolate. There's so much to experience, good and bad, and I just think that in the next 10 years, chocolate's going to a whole new place. Now, most people don't know that chocolate was just nearly extinct. And 10 years ago, we got involved in a group that started working with the FDA. The FDA has a genome bank of cocoa where the original strains are housed. In the 60s, the big companies planted what are known as bulk beans, which were manipulated beans that make big, big pods with lots of big beans and not much flavor. And they planted those all the way around the cocoa growing belt, 21 degrees north and south. And what happened is that cocoa didn't have the millions of years of disease resistance, so all the cocoa got sick. And it got clear down to where there was only 5% native beans left on Earth. And this is horrifying because, you know, carob is neat stuff, but it is not chocolate. So the FDA had done their genome bank, and then we started planting the good beans back around the bad ones, and the little midges that pollinate this started changing the way things were going, so the chocolate started getting better and better. It's now 10% worldwide instead of 5%, so we've doubled it worldwide. That's amazing in 10 years.
And looking forward, you're optimistic.
Yeah, chocolate is supposed to be exponentially going up, maybe 30% native beans this year. And we're keeping our fingers crossed, but it looks like we're in the clear and things are going to keep improving.
Mike Dunn, I'm going to have to come back for lesson number 2 in chocolate. But this has been a great day. Thank you for sharing. Mike Dunn.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. My name is Rachel Dunn from Rachel Dunn Chocolates. We are in Concord, California at racheldunnchocolates.com.
Thanks, Rachel. I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Concord, California. We'll see you here with a sweet tooth.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
Associate producers include Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Molly Blaisdell, San Francisco, and Katya Singel, San Luis Obispo, California.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided in part by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. To find a St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in your area, visit svdpusa.org.